petition number 22333, Rule 3.
This is the second reel of a taped interview with Jim McKenzie in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 31st of the 7th, 2001, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Jim, could you describe the atmosphere in Perth as you marched down St George's Terrace, William Street, then down St George's Terrace to the Esplanade?
It was terrific. The atmosphere, and as we marched, the streets were absolutely fully lined with people, men, women and children, and it's terrific. The thing I noticed, that I never knew a person, I never saw a person that I knew, but mind you, it was a case where we were very highly trained, and I was very conscientious of the fact that I marched with looking straight ahead. But I remember our sergeant, who was a very popular man, he was killed in Syria, but he had been with a big, large firm in Perth, and that large firm had thronged the footpath, and they absolutely cheered. I never heard anything like it as he went past. And that was the atmosphere it was, but I remember that happened again, not only the sergeant, but other coaches who'd been to soldier who'd been one of the big firms in Perth. They all came out and they cheered him like mad.
What do you think that says to you about the way people viewed who you were in regard being a soldier for Australia?
Yeah, I think it was so. They're very patriotic, there's no doubt about it. There'd been that lapse from between the First World War, and also the fact is that when the 6th Divy was a different matter, that was new. They went trained and all went away to England, to the Eastern States, and then came back. But the feeling hadn't built up in those days to what it was when we went away. That's how I might be wrong there, but that's what I think was the thing. It was the people were working so much harder then. They'd formed all the goodwill people, the comfort people in Perth, and the bands and all those sort of things had all been formed. And people had volunteered, so many had volunteered and who were waiting to get away, and their families were conscious of this. And were very patriotic.
So the war effort was gearing up?
The war was gearing up, definitely gearing up.
But the effort to be behind?
Yes, but because nobody realised. Well, see, we thought that we were going to go to England. We had no idea that we were going to have to go to the same area that they fought out in Palestine. In the First World War, we had no idea of that. We thought we'd go to England, like the 6th Divy thought the same, and some of our troops did go to England, and eventually we went to the Middle East instead.
What were the bonds that you were developing with your other comrades?
That is something we've always thought about. Australia was so different, and in the regard of our mateship, comradeship, the Americans, they when they came in the war some years later, they came from all parts of America, and went into a unit, and England was the same, except when they formed the regulars, the troops in England, like the territorials and the guards and all that mob. But when the conscripts came in, they came from all over England. But in our case, it was different. We seemed to enlist in mass from the country. And in my section, when I went away, it changed a little bit, because what we call the useless and toothless, the old and bold, they fell out in Palestine. They went to the Corps Guards. Quite a few of them were First World War men. But in my section, I had of 9 men and myself, 10 men, there were 7 from the same country town who all knew each other in the town. And that happened a lot. And it happened, we had 2 companies from Kalgoorlie who came, or 2 companies, but they eventually formed a platoon in each company of Kalgoorlie chaps. And they had that bond between them. Manjimup was the same, Pemberton was the same, Collie was the same. Those men all came in and they formed together and went into the unit. When you came into the camp in Northam, you met these chaps, or you came in together, and you said, oh, we'll go to town. And then you went to C Company, and in C Company you went to one of the platoons, 3 platoons in the company. You went to that platoon where the rest of the mob were, and that's how it was. It was different in the Perth regard, in some ways, but Perth being such a small place that they knew quite a, I wouldn't say they knew each other, but they knew of each other sort of business. Where in the other states, Melbourne and Victoria, and those places were different. It's not the same. It was the same in Adelaide, where the 2nd 27th formed from the 27th Battalion, and they'd formed that way. And in the same here, we got sergeants and NCOs from the 4 battalions already formed in West Australia, like the 16th Battalion, Cameron Highlanders. They came to our mob, into our show, and together. And that was what the mateship was about.
What was the feeling then as you realised that you were off to Fremantle, you were going to get on a ship and head off? What were you talking to your comrades and mates about?
How much we could get into our packs, how to pack. In my sixth case, we had a man who'd been 7 years Irish Guards, and he could pack a pack one like nobody else could. He could fold an overcoat up like nobody else could, a great coat, you call them, like nobody else could. And he's a wonderful advantage. And we were given a kit bag. We had our packs, and then we had our kit bag, and then we got a sea kit bag. The idea was we took that on the ship and threw it away when we got that stuff. We didn't want it any longer. And we had this leave before we knew we were going, and we had this leave. We didn't actually know when we were going. It was a secret move sort of business. Nobody was told. The camp was closed. Nobody in and out of the camp, very secret. And when we moved, and in my case, my aunt and my sister, with their car, followed the train all the way down to Perth. And as we stopped at the different place, the sidings along the where we did stop, I think there were 3 stops coming down. Kajeta was the first. The chaps scribbled bits of paper and went across to the car with my sister in it. Said, "Look, you send this telegram. Put in a telegram, send away." And I believe I think my sister said she had sent 23 telegrams for the secret move. See, and then we got to Perth. And the first thing we did when we came to Perth, Rose Street were all out, all the Rose Street brothels were all lining the street. They knew what it was on. They knew all about it, sort of as we were moving. And then we got to Fremantle, and everybody's down Fremantle seeing us off. The big Aquitania couldn't come to harbour. It was out of about 4 miles or 5 miles out. We had to go out on lighters to the Aquitania. But they knew the big Aquitania ship was there, and they knew that it wasn't there for loading coal or anything else. It was going to load troops, and they all knew it was going away. We were going away. There was no secrecy about it. That's how it was. But we, I don't know, we had a euphoria, I suppose. I had a flag, and all the platoons signed that flag, and just loved the company. And when I got free metal, I didn't know what to do with it, so I gave to one of the old and bold, the greenies who were guarding the wharf, and gave to him. And said, oh, you better have this sort of business. And that's how, well, we knew we were going, and we took these things, but I don't know. I can't remember very well.
What was the atmosphere on the wharf?
Well, everybody was held back. They had barricades there, and we unloaded off the train onto the wharf directly, and we never saw the people. We saw things that surprised the Victorians, because when we got out the Aquitania, there were all these caves on the sort of surfboards from the surf clubs, and they'd come out on these boards and were circling the ship and their things. And the shock we got when we got out to Aquitania was seeing all these white-faced, long-haired chaps with it hang over the rail. Because we had had the driest summer for years and years in Northern, and we'd all shaved our head off. The only chap in our turn of hand shave was Paddy Connolly, who was the 7 years Irish Guard, and he knew that we couldn't save him without knocking him about. And so he was the only one in Australia, and here we went to on board the ship. Victoria had had a very wet year. It had the all pale face, all white faced, and very white faced, and they hang over the rails, and we were all brown faced and buried, bald heads, shaved heads, got a lot of scarecrow hair on our heads. And of course, we all took our hats off when we got there and showed them our heads. And they were shocked, and we were shocked to see them. They looked so pale.
This would be the first time you'd been on a ship. What was the feeling?
No, I'd been, during the First World War, I'd been from Perth to Sydney on a ship, on the Zindara, that was eventually torpedoed in the Mediterranean.
A ship of this size?
Oh, no, I've never been on a big ship like that. Aquitania. That was the original Aquitania, not the another Aquitania as well, the later one.
What was the feeling going out to Gage Rose then, seeing this?
Oh, well, that's how it was. We were out there and we got on the ship and we were treated like dirt sort of business. It became British regulations and we were down 7 decks, I think it was, down in the hole there. And down right under there, and it was a hellhole, there's no doubt about it.
Describe it to us a bit, if you can.
Well, it was summertime, and the ship was hot as hell, and we were allowed up on deck occasionally, and we'd line up for our beer. We had got a beer, non-alcoholic beer issued to us, a Victorian beer, and we lined up for that, and we had a pair of shorts on, and that was all. In most cases, underpants, and where we stood, there'd be a pool of sweat on the ground. It'd be just wet on the ground. There'd be actually a pool of sweat where each man stood waiting to get his beer. It was that hot. And we get this hot beer, and it was moderately cool. And we'd go up on deck, and we'd be on the lower deck, on the deck itself, and up above us would be the B deck and A deck, or the what they call the boat deck and the A deck. And there the officers and sergeants would be drinking their gin and their slings and everything else sort of business, and we wouldn't have a drink. And in my case, I was lucky. I had got a couple of drinks because I had friends who were I knew very well in civil life, and they were sergeants, and they used to come down the gangway with a glass of grog in their hand, covered up with their hand, and hand it to me at the bottom of the stairway, and I'd swab it off quickly, and they'd go back up the stairs again. But I was a lucky one. Not many chaps did it. Three or four my mates were there with me waiting to get there and share, and that's how it was. But it was terrible. That's how I thought.
What were the sleeping arrangements like?
Well, in a bank. We had bunks, and the two of us to a cabin, and we were corporals, and two of us to a cabin down below. When they thought there was a man overboard, we were right down below in the stern of the ship, right on the propeller shaft. And one night when they thought there was a man overboard, they hurt the Navy very much to doing it, but they turned the ship around and went back looking for the soldier had fallen overboard. It hadn't been somebody who chucked a sandbag overboard, I believe. But when they turned around, we were just thrown out of our bunks. The vibration of the propeller shaft underneath our bunk just threw us out of our bunk. When we got on board, the platoon commander came down and searched all our bags, and the chaplain with me, who had been a barman in civil life, he had a bottle of whiskey and a bottle of something else and a couple of bottles of beer. And, of course, that was all confiscated. We don't know what happened. It probably went up to the officer's mess, but that was confiscated. All our gear was searched to see if he didn't bring any goggles aboard. And that was it.
What about food? What sort of food were you to receive on board ship?
I don't remember. I honestly don't remember. It was just plain tucker. If it had been good, we would have been good, but it was good for what we had later on. There's no doubt about that. I can't remember the tuck at all. All I remember, the boxing competitions, and that was about all I can remember on the board. And the boat drill, of course.
So what could you describe to us what the average day was like on board ship?
Hanging over the rail, watching the sea. That's all I remember. We didn't do any... Which we were too packed tight to do any drill or anything else like that. And that's all I remember. We just hang over the rail watching the sea.
Can you make a guess as to how many people were on board ship?
Oh, no, I can't remember. I was probably 3,000 or something like that. I can't remember. Two battalions, the 14th and us, and brigade headquarters. We had 1,000 men. They had 1,000 men. That's 2,000. And then the auxiliaries, the hospital unit and something else, I should say about 3,000.
You're mentioning standing on board deck. What was it like seeing Western Australia disappear over the horizon?
Never saw it. We were sent down below to get our accommodation. I don't think we saw any of it.
What was the feeling then?
Oh, wait a moment, that's right. I remember being up on deck, seeing it for a little while, but that's all I can't remember.
What was the feeling then, realising that you were going away, you were heading off to war? Did you have any concerns for your future?
Yeah, we were scared, because scared in this way that we had one cruiser, the HMAS Australia, I think, took us for our escort for a start. But no, I don't say I was scared so much. We knew that if anything happened, we'd drown. We knew that. We were given life jackets, and we were told that they were useless. Well, they weren't. The people who issued to them didn't tell us they were useless, but we heard from other people that they're useless, the old cork life jacket. When you jump down from the high deck into the water, you'd break your neck with them. And we were told that. No, I don't think we were scared, but we were scared. I don't know. We knew that the ship was fairly fast, and we were on our own sort of business. I think it was the Queen Mary was with us, I think, and she went off and went up to Singapore. She turned around and went up to Singapore, I think. But I can't remember much of it.
Did you ever think that you might not come back to Australia? That you might...
No. No, never thought of the future at all. Never gave it a thought. At one stage I thought how silly I was, because the man I was with, He's a very, very well-known West, the man I've jackarooed for, very well-known West Australian. He went away as a trooper in the Light Horse because he's young and he's a late reinforcement. And he said to me, "Jim, never go away unless you go away as an officer. Never go away unless you go away as an officer. Life's not worth living as a soldier." I remember him telling me that. And I didn't realise at the time. I realised it later on, I do. Once I got to Bombay. And I didn't realise it then. Because we were in Australia with all the Australian way of life.
Well, tell us about the trip.
Well, what I mean, when you got to...
Getting to Bombay, what was some of the...
Well, I had a row with made an enemy of the Sergeant Major back in Australia. And he got it back on me and reported to my company commander that I was trying to get some of the men to mutiny about the shore leave. It was totally untrue. So what I saw Bombay, we got out off at the Bombay. We went ashore in a corvette. We went up, caught a train up to Dilali, which is 100 miles out from Bombay. The train went like mad, travelled at 60, 70, 80 miles an hour, electric train, I think it was. We got to Dilali. We went into an ex-British Army camp, which was a rough camp. It was a sort of... The beds were made of straps, and under each strap, wherever each strap crossed, there's bloody tick and lice, and they gave us hell. And my first day there, I was pulled out, and I, for my sins, I was told to march to the shortest men in my platoon, out of my platoon, up and down the hillside with four bricks in their pack for 2 hours. That was their punishment, British Army style. As soon as we got on that boat, we adopted British Army style. And that was their punishment. I actually never knew what they did wrong, but I got into trouble, according to my Sergeant Major, who I never got on with. And that was my job. Anyhow, I got a touch of dysentery, and everybody went off. I didn't see another soul. The sergeant came at the end of the first hour and then disappeared, platoon sergeant. And after the first hour, I broke these two chaps off and said, "Right, that's enough. I'm off." And I got a touch of dysentery, and I remember it's the worst thing I've ever had in my life, dysentery. It's a shocker. And I had a dysentery, but of course we wouldn't report to the RAP because we were frightened of being left behind. If you got sick in India, you went to a British camp there and you were left behind, the battalion went on. So we spent a week up there while the rest of my war went in the bazaars and caused a lot of trouble.
What sort of trouble?
Oh, well, they couldn't understand the dealings with the Indians, who they called wogs. They couldn't understand anything, and when they bought a lot of useless stuff, like chains for hanging their dog medals on, and the chains just broke, weren't any good at all. And they took them back and argued with them, and a bit of a fight here and there. But I didn't know anything about that, because I just lay there with dysentery. And it was a terrible thing. It's really terrible. I got over it in time to go away with the battalion. But I didn't report sick. I should have. But that's how it was.
So what was the feeling then of you seeing these different parts of the world, seeing Bombay, having come from Australia?
Yes, well, it was totally strange. But again, I was lucky, I suppose, that I we had a day's leave in Bombay, and I knew of a chap there who knew of a chap, and this chap knew Higgins, the top trainer in Bombay, an Australian, and so we went out to his stables. And I'd always been interested in horses, and another chap and myself. We went out and spent the day in his stables. And it was an eye-opener to me, because a horse there was that well cared for, it had a groom attending to it all the time. And that horse was treated like a queen or king. And I couldn't understand why they all covered. They always had the rugs on. Higgins told us that any other trainers know what their house looked like and how it was. And they kept these rugs on all the time so that the others would know what the horse looked like. And of course, when they exercised them, they had to take a rug off then at a gallop, but otherwise the rugs were on all the time. And all the grooming was done by hand. Horses were rubbed by hand, massaged by hand all the time. And it was a wonderful sight for me. I'd never seen a horse treated. I'd been to local stables in Perth. I've never seen horses treated like that was.
People talk of leaving and going away to war as an adventure. Is that something that you were looking for?
No, far from it. I was too old for it. I was 30, not the 31 actually. But it wasn't an adventure to me. See, we were all mates. We were all friends. And I knew so many chaps before I joined up and after I joined up. I knew them when we joined up. And we shared these things. We got on a boat that was used for troop carrying from England to England to India by the British. It was a P&O boat, I think, owned it, a little tiny boat, very small. And there, it was the same old story, a bit of cockroaches galore, and our tucker at night time was a bit of rotten cheese and a biscuit. That's what we ate at night time, and an onion. And I saw sheep, the coarse sheep, we would have not even had them on a farm, but they're Indian sheep. They looked like a skinny goat, and they were on board. I don't know whether they had a freeze or not, but they hacked about, and they put into a stew, and we got that issue for our lunch. That was our issue for our lunch.
What was the feeling then of the command that could be supplying you with this level of...
Well, we were told it was British rations. And we knew, we'd heard about the British Army, Bob O'Day stuff. And that was. Now, it was unbelievable what that was like. All the chaps still talk about it, the one who left now. We've talked about it since a lot. And they had wide mess tables. And we used to sleep on these mess tables, and we'd sweat on the mess tables, and then we'd have our food on the mess tables, on the sweat with our food. Nothing to wipe them down with, sort of. You could go with the elbow, sort of, and wipe them down. But it was just sweaty, all going through the Red Sea. It was just really sweaty. The only turnaround there was that we had a gunship, aerial gunship with us. And an ITAI plane came over, a recce plane came over and had a look at us. And the gunship fired at it and drove it off. But that was the only excitement we had. Then we got to the canal. And when we went through the canal, we saw these New Zealanders on the banks. They were only a few yards away each side of the ship because it's very narrow, the canal. Every New Zealander seemed to have a nurse or a lady with him, an army lady, and we thought this was wonderful, but of course was the, I suppose it was the officers and the headquarter crowd. And we went up there and we got off at Quintara, I think it was. And, got that name, I think it's Quintara.
El Quintara.
And there I got another shock. We went down the gangway, only off this little small ship. And at the bottom of the gangway, there's a little wog. And the first words he said to me, "Carry your bag, Mr. McKenzie."